Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
The bus from Mundubbera to Childers left on a Wednesday. Tia Poe had booked her seat and committed to her next challenge.
I was actually working in a citrus orchard in Mundubbera and decided to go to Childers just on a whim. It was a bit of a random decision to travel over there by myself. And I was quite determined that it was going to be at the palace. For some reason, I have no idea why, but I set my sights on going to the palace.
She was from New Zealand's South Island. She'd been working and travelling on both sides of Australia for a few months and had broad plans to make it back to Western Australia. Picking crops was easy money and eventually it would pay for her return across the Nullarbor. So she zeroed in on Childers and arrived late on the 21st of June. The next night, the palace was set alight.
Well, initially, I woke up, there was a smashing glass, so I could hear the smashing glass, and then, so I'm thinking, is there a fight downstairs, you know, like what's going on, and I heard glass smashing again, so yeah, so you just kind of like, you're stirred, and then something, I guess I put all the noises together, because I just instantly, my heart rate went up and I took a deep breath and I yelled out, fire, that's fire. Because I remember Lita, she was in the bunk underneath me. She's like, what the hell is that noise? And once we realised, we just jumped out of bed. Sheesh, remembering that is quite intense.
It's still very raw and justifiably so. Tia concedes she's easily triggered by Childers, its story and the entire experience of surviving the fire. The bad and the good, which these days mostly outweighs the negative. There is significant emotional baggage which she's waded and navigated her way through as an evolving process for the past 20 years. It remains very much a work in progress. Thing is, Childers was only part of her ordeal.
Pretty much in the middle of the building. And there were two doors, two entry points, one leading right into the centre of the building and the other door leading into a corridor. So it felt like a bit of a rabbit warren up there, quite thin corridors leading all over the place.
Tia was in room 5. It's upstairs. She's rooming with Kubo from Japan and Lita Grindley from England, who first hears the commotion and jumps up to turn on the light. Now, it stays on for just a brief moment, but long enough to get a sense of what they were confronting.
The smoke was black and it was halfway down the really high ceilings and, you know, my head was pretty much in this black smoke. And the girl who was on the top bunk, she'd been breathing it in, and she jumped down. And I just remembered, I just huddled against the wall because I didn't understand why I was still there. I didn't understand why nobody had come to get me. Yeah, so there was a bit of a panic.
It was confusing. She was half asleep, recovering from her first and what would be only day picking on the same zucchini farm as Sarah Marnie and Lauren Morris. And no alarms. Surely if there was a serious fire, alarms would be sounding, right? So there was a sense of reality not quite matching up with the illusion and expectation.
Not just, you know, a little bit of smoke. It was huge by that stage, and I couldn't understand why I was still in the building. I couldn't understand why I hadn't been, you know, warned, alerted. Yeah, it was just really hard for my mind to comprehend what I was still doing in there and why I hadn't been rescued. I guess you have a tendency to think you're going to get rescued. So that was my initial thought, was someone was going to save me. But you get out of that pretty quickly because you know no one's going to save you. And if you don't get out, you're toast. You're going to die.
It's a horrible realisation that she's on her own. Her fate is up to her. There's only one choice, and there's no time to waste.
Well, Lita, I just remember her yelling balcony, and she ran. She opened the door and she ran out the door, and I just, something just kicks in. You're like, okay, you got to go. And all of that stuff that you taught when you're younger about fires, about get low, because I was just a panicking mess, get low, it just sort of kicked in, and I dropped to the ground, and my other roommate, I felt her clutch onto my leg, and we just started crawling, and I chose to go left, because I remember that was the direction of the balcony, but by that stage, even low, my lungs were just hurting so much that I didn't know if I was going to make it at that point, but I just kept on crawling.
It's too much. She's out of breath. There's no clean air to inhale. Tia's now reached a point of panic, despair, and sheer helplessness.
I kept crawling, and I felt someone, you know, on my leg, and I got to a point, it couldn't have been long, but I just got to a point where I just got lost. I felt lost. I didn't know where I was. Everything was black. I couldn't breathe. And this kind of, I guess it was a calmness came over me, like, this is bullshit. I'm going to go back to sleep. That's kind of what I thought.
Sounds familiar, right? We heard that from Sarah Marnie in episode one. And remember, Kate Morris said she was overcome with exhaustion and this desire to just doze off. Now Tia as well. It intrigued me, so I lined up a chat with Guy Marks. He's a researcher on lung disease and air pollution at Sydney University and a respiratory physician.
But the things that you burn in, that you inhale from the burning of the fire, are particles that are basically carbon particles that are released by the combustion process, and also carbon monoxide. In the outdoor environment, that carbon monoxide tends to spread around quite a bit, and it's quite hard for the levels in the outdoor environment to get up very high. But in an indoor environment where there's a fire, the levels can become very high, and many people who are affected by smoke inhalation from a house fire, the thing that is most dangerous to them, apart from the fire itself, is carbon monoxide poisoning.
And that's exactly what these people in that building would have encountered that night.
That's correct, yeah.
Survivors that I've spoken to have talked about this overwhelming sensation of wanting to just have a sleep while they're trying to escape. Is that something you've heard before?
Essentially, it causes you to become unconscious. And so coming unconscious, I guess, is a sense of falling asleep. That doesn't all that much surprise me. But what happens when you get carbon monoxide poisoning is you lose consciousness.
How long have they got? Once they start taking that in, how long do you think you've got?
Essentially, carbon monoxide poisoning largely is the result of replacement of oxygen. And so people die of lack of oxygen and carbon monoxide poisoning.
Is that seconds? Is it minutes?
Minutes, we're talking, yeah, minutes.
Minutes, if that. When you think of it that way, it's a rather acute reflection on just how bad things must have been at that moment for everyone trying to escape the building. It's in those moments you just hope there's something extra you can find, an energy reserve deep down that pushes you to safety, or just a stroke of plain old good luck.
And I did kind of feel really sleepy at that point. And I remember this gush of heat coming out at me, and I turned my head and I saw the balcony. I'd crawled to a point where down low I could actually see the outside, and decided to sleep. Well, yeah, just went for it. Went for outside, got out onto the balcony. Oh, my lungs, they hurt so much. And I was still, I think I was going into shock about then. I remember turning back to the door and yelling fire, because I knew that I was in there. I was trapped in there. So I knew other people were still in there. I just had this feeling, but I couldn't do anything. I couldn't go back in, and I couldn't really yell, and I was really starting to go into shock at that stage. And I just looked around. I looked downstairs, and there were people sort of running around with their bags, and someone yelled out, "Call the fire brigade!" And I'm thinking, "Fuck!" You know, like, no one's called the fire brigade yet. Like, what the fuck is going on? Sorry, my language. Yeah, that just freaked me out even more.
She got out via the balcony, helped down an escape ladder by fellow backpacker Yoki Visser. She braved the elements, defied evil, and just beat the clock.
I mean, we walked across the road. Someone gave me a blanket. I remember wrapping myself in that, and it wasn't long after I got off there. It just looked like it exploded. There were flames shooting off the balcony, and then I realised that, you know, if anyone was in there, they weren't getting out. They weren't getting out of there.
A matter of minutes at the most.
Yeah.
Determined.
Yeah.
Who died and who lived.
Yeah. Yeah. It was only minutes after I got off that balcony that it blew. It didn't take long. It's kind of quite harrowing when you think how just that little bit of time matters. That little bit of time, if I didn't see the balcony, or yeah, if I didn't see that fresh air, yeah, I just would have passed out, I'd say.
That thought sitting inside your head's not healthy and not good for you. How have you managed to reconcile that?
You know, I just happened to be lucky, possibly guided. It's just chance, really, that I happened to get out and the others didn't. Where I was, there's a whole heap of things go through your mind why you're out and they aren't. But I think we all know how close it was for everyone up there. That is really just a game of minutes.
Tia has remained in touch with Lita, although she too has done it tough since Childers, and that's understating it. She's never seen Kobu again.
The Japanese consulate came up on the morning of the fire, and I think there were five Japanese staying there at the time. Language was another thing that was difficult when you're trying to help them, language difficulties. But they just came up from Brisbane, picked the five of them up and took them away. That was it. That was the last we saw of them. Just different ways of handling things, yeah. You know, from the different nationalities.
Among the 15 victims of the fire, Atsushi Toyona, who was one of the 10 guests who died in room 7.
He was working out on the Goodwood avocado farm.
Okay.
And his family came out and we took them out to the farm and drove them around, and the owners of the farm showed him exactly where the tree was that he was working on, and they've set up a little memorial plaque and everything to him out there at the farm, at the property itself.
One of the hardest things for the survivors was hitting the reset button, coming to terms with what had happened, taking stock and being able to function normally. Sure, for the first time in their lives, there were television cameras pointing a lens at any sign of movement, and that was both unusual and claustrophobic at the same time. But it was more than that. The balance was all wrong. Their core sense of being, it needed recalibrating. But there was no easy fix. They found themselves planted firmly in either column A or column B, mentally traumatised by what they'd just endured and carrying a version of survivor's guilt, or overcompensating and pinging from one task to the next, doing nothing well, not completing tasks, but trying to cram in as much as possible, because suddenly it had dawned on them that life is bloody short and it could be taken away when you least expect it in an instant. In the immediate aftermath of the fire, community volunteers let that process take its course and were there for anything and everything just to aid their recovery.
I just remember thinking, I've got a headache, and someone overheard that, and next thing there's boxes of Panadol everywhere. So, yeah, I took some of those, and I remember someone saying, you know, would you like to come to my house and have a shower? And I'm like, oh, that'd be great. But then you have this realisation, I don't have any clothes to change into, I don't have any soap, I don't have a towel, I don't have a toothbrush. And honestly, within an hour, there's like a table full of all of that stuff right there, you know, and you would, you know, grab a towel and a change of clothes and some shampoo and then toddle off to someone's house to shower in their house. And it's all very surreal.
And nothing was off limits or too difficult. Not many were privy to the scars the survivors were already carrying.
We had no accommodation for the kids. I mean, it was down to the motel. We had no beds or anything. And they shushed people out of the motel everywhere to put the kids in there to give them somewhere they could stay until we got them sorted out.
Everyone was like kind of sleeping everywhere. Our doors were always open. I think it was, I remember one guy, G-Man, he actually slept outside of the motel units on the first night because he couldn't go inside a building. He couldn't sleep inside, so he slept in a sleeping bag outside. So we tend to, you know, have our doors open, and, yeah, we're all pretty terrified.
Even in the middle of winter, after a night like they'd endured, sleeping inside a confined hotel room was just too much to bear. June 23 didn't just claim lives. It changed so many others forever.
Yeah, I remember saying, "You okay?" And he's like, "Yeah, I can't go inside." I'm like, "Fair enough," because I don't think I slept that first night. I remember going off for a walk in the dark, and I met. It was a fireman standing stationed outside the hostel. He'd come up to me. He's like, "You right, love?" And I'm like, "I can't sleep." And so he walked me over to the cultural centre, and we sat down, and we had a cup of tea. And I talked about, you know, my experience to him, and he shared some things with me, and it was a really nice moment, really, just having that connection. Strangers just wanting to be there to listen, yeah, and to be there for you. It didn't matter that it was 2 in the morning. There was someone around. There was always someone around in those following days. If you wanted to be at the cultural centre at 3 a.m., there was someone there making you a cup of tea. It was very communal. We just looked after each other. And it was really nice to have that space while we were processing what had happened and you know, thinking about the next stages of what we were going to do.
Tia stayed for a fortnight before joining a group of the survivors who headed north for a beach escape. They did that for a few weeks.
And then there was a point where I felt like I needed to get back to work and have some sort of normality. It was just something that I felt like I needed to do. So I tried in Bowen. And I kept crying, you know. I was that girl because I'd separated from everybody at that stage. I worked one day in Bowen. I got on a bus and there were a bunch of people on the bus and I just started crying because, you know, it was like there's 15 people on this bus and that's a lot of people. And I was the girl who was, you know, that strange girl who's always crying. So I had to get out of there. I just felt really self-conscious about that, about people maybe talking about me or not knowing anything about me. That lack of connection, that lack of being around people who knew.
Being on her own and dealing with what happened in Childers in solidarity was a personal choice, but perhaps it wasn't the right one so soon. Still, she pressed on and headed about an hour up the road to a town called Ayr.
With a fresh start. It was pretty similar. I cried a lot there. I couldn't sleep at night. I tried really hard to sort of get back to normal, whatever that was. And I was still definitely very traumatised. But, you know, I got up and I went to work and then that went okay.
She'd been there 3 days and motivation was tough. The next day she decided against driving to work and jumped on the shuttle bus instead. After a long day picking eggplants, it was time to head home. She was one of the last two people to get on the bus. With two seats available, she chose the one in a middle row. The other guy, a Brit named Jason Walsh, took the one at the back.
And then just realising, no, he's not slowing down, he's not slowing down. And there was a four-wheel drive on the highway. You know, it's going highway speeds, 100k. And our van just went straight through the stop sign and I braced because I was watching it happen. I braced and it hit us like at 100k and I felt like I flew across the side of the van and impact was pretty intense. We spun, flipped, people were flying out the back window. It was just carnage.
One of those was Jason. There were 14 people on that bus. Two died, including Jason. After a checkup at the hospital, Tia was one of two people who walked away from the crash with nothing more than just a few bruises.
I was really traumatised. I had PTSD for a long time over that. I didn't want to drive. I was still having massive flashbacks after the fire. I was thinking that everything was fire. The cat jumping off the bench was fire. I was seeing it, like literally seeing the smoke and hearing the flames. I didn't sleep at night for, I don't know, maybe a year. Especially on windy nights. I couldn't drive. I was a nightmare. If I had to be driven by somebody, I'd be like, it's a stop sign. You know, you've got to slow down. Just always hypervigilant. So I carried that PTSD for a long time. But eventually, with some help, I managed to put that in its place.
Word got out. And the media got wind of the story. It made the news, which Tia found not only difficult to comprehend, but tough to reason with. But it led to a rather beautiful exchange, which kind of linked this entire crazy six-week ordeal of tragedy and extreme grief and the questions she was asking herself of her own mortality and her struggle to process it all.
It was the following day, so or even the day after, it's a bit of a blur, a Japanese girl came up to me and she said, "Tia, you know, were you in the fire?" And I said, "Yeah, I was." And she said, "Me too." And I looked at her and I did actually, it all came back to me because they had been whisked away quite fast by the Japanese consulate, you know, taking care of them. So we never really got to know each other. And when she said me too, we just, we clung to each other. We just like full on clung to each other and started crying. It was quite an intense experience. And for me, it was, God, thank God, you know, because I'm so alone. I felt so alone because I didn't have anyone from the fire with me. I had people who had survived the accident with me, but with both of those things compounded, I felt really isolated. It's like I didn't feel like anyone could really understand what I was going through.
It felt like things had gone full circle. She'd gone from the highs and fun of the itinerant working lifestyle and the constant development of friendships to the devastation of Childers. Her freedom had essentially disappeared. She'd become a prisoner inside her own head. She spent more than a month looking for ways to make sense of things, then chose to self-isolate, move on, and compartmentalise the narrative of her life. Now there was a new, shocking chapter playing out. But suddenly, through mutual understanding and shared living, her worlds were colliding.
It took years to get to a point where I could sleep well at night and function well. I had the help of a really good psychologist for, I think, a year. I saw him quite regularly, helped me sort of piece things together. Helped me overcome, you know, some of the more traumatic things. I was living things over and over because the PTSD was quite extreme when I got home. I've managed to stay really well for the last 15 years, actually. I mean, you never recover from something like that. You know, it's always a part of you. But I've moved past that. Like, life isn't just about that. It doesn't define me anymore.
Hardly a day goes by when Tia doesn't think about Childers. She knows it's just become part of her being. It's how she deals with it, how she dictates the memories that continue to be self-managed. And you know what? It's worked.
The anniversary is always quite a somber event for me. For all of us, probably, we would start off like having 15 shots together or lighting 15 candles. There's always something, there's a significance, like a heaviness to this day. And it would carry all day, sometimes leading up to it. But it's just, there's always a part of you that will just always stop and remember.
These days, the shots have stopped and candles are lit for a different reason.
It didn't actually cross my mind what was going on, which is kind of weird. My firstborn was due on the 18th of June. It really hit me when I gave birth to my firstborn on the 23rd of June. And I'm holding him in the delivery room and realising the date. You know, it was more significant than lighting 15 candles, that's for sure. Yeah, to give birth to my first son on the anniversary, on the 11th anniversary of the fire was, you know, it was pretty amazing, pretty profound, really.
When did it occur to you? Like, when do you remember that?
Yeah, it occurred to me like when I gave birth to him and he was on me, and then I realized the date. Yeah, it was like, wow. Circle of life. This is profound. to bring life and to the world on that day. That so much was taken away, and that I just about lost my life on that day, and now I have my baby on that day. And now, you know, it's changed for me. That day I make birthday cakes and we throw parties, and it's about him. And there's always a part of my day, though, and there probably always will be. There's a part of my day that's about them. And it can be around midnight when I light a candle and remember them. And then I light candles for my boy on his birthday. Yeah.
What's his
pretty
name?
Cool. Luca, which means bringer of light. Yeah, bringer of light. Luca.
Bringer of light. Certainly a new energy on a day that has for too long been shrouded in darkness. He'll turn 9 on the anniversary of the fire. Happy birthday, Luca. And thank you to his mum, Tia, for sharing her story in this episode. It was written and produced by me, Paul Cochran. And I'd like to give a shout out to the man who has been doing all the amazing editing and providing all the incredible original sound design and composition you've been hearing on this series. He is a talent indeed, and he has worked tirelessly to pull this together. Zoltan Fetcher, it is so appreciated. My thanks to the Bundaberg Regional Council for their support of this podcast. They manage and maintain the memorial to the victims in Childers. It is a beautiful tribute. If you can, please do pop in for a visit and pay your respects. Don't forget to subscribe to this podcast. Please tell your family and friends. Until next time, thank you for listening.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50. Luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.